Greetings, Ghost Family. Welcome back to our FamGo Show bonus episode series, coming at you once a month all summer long while we work on our second season of stories. Speaking of which, I have just returned from a remote cabin in eastern Washington State, part of our team's flurry of reporting adventures, some of which are going very well.
It's easy just to talk to you guys. You're very easy to talk to.
And others of which, well,
I think we definitely want to take a right here.
Onto the train tracks.
But maybe right. Cruise down the train tracks. Not necessarily.
Periodic snafus aside, we are so excited about this slate of stories that we're preparing for you to hear when our second season launches on October 10th, just a terrifyingly small number of months from now. But in the meantime, for this month's bonus episode, per usual, we'll bring you the latest installment in our ongoing series.
Wild Card
Wednesday. Wild Card Wednesday.
On Wild Card Wednesday this month, a piece of slam poetry about a character in one of our season one stories. But first, we're going to change things up a little bit this month. Speaking of season one, if you're hearing this, there's a good chance you've listened to episode 5, a story called Lookin' Good Charlie, told by Mark Pagan. I first met Mark in 2014, when he told a story at an open mic I used to host here in New York called Dingmantics.
So my grandmother worked in the mall, and as a kid, I think I was the only boy who went to the mall to hang out with his grandmother. And Woodward and Lord, we call it Woody.
I became a fan of Mark's storytelling instantly. He's warm, funny, sincere, and I love the way he writes about himself. The version of Mark you meet in his stories is this winsome mix of curiosity, courage, and haplessness. And last year, he combined a series of his stories with his audio production skills to create a podcast called Other Men Need Help, a playful mix of autobiography, documentary, and original reporting that deconstructs what Mark likes to call the emblems, habits, and struts in the male performance. Mark's first season of Other Men Need Help wrapped last winter, and today on the show, you're going to hear an episode from that initial run called Manual Men Part 2. It's a story that expands on a lot of the themes he explored in the episode we made with him for our show, the frustrating legacy of his father, people who are more than meet the eye, and the mystical allure of the standard transmission. All you need to know for this story to make sense is that earlier in the series, Mark goes on a date with a woman named Shripa that doesn't end well, which leads to an overwhelming temptation to buy a used Mazda RX-7. We'll have Mark take it from there.
During my freshman year of high school, I'd spend cold mornings waiting for the 1221 school bus. I lived on Falls Road, which was, and still is, a major route for students driving to some of the high schools in Montgomery County, Maryland. Every day, juniors and seniors would whiz by. Some of them liked to let me know when they were driving by.
Punk ass! Chewbacca!
It sucked. I'd be standing there with my headphones listening to Cypress Hill, and all these flashy cars were going by just laughing at me. This one day, a 1994 Nissan Maxima with tinted windows, neon ground effects, and alloy rims slows down and pulls over in front of me. I know this car. Chris Papadopoulos drives it. Chris was a senior who always had the flyest gear, like gold chains and brand new sports attire. Whatever team won the Super Bowl, Chris would be wearing their celebratory swag on Monday morning. He was that guy. Very cool. And I was nowhere on his radar. So on this one morning, I see his car sitting there, but can't see inside because of the tinted windows. Does he have a flat? What the hell is going on? Then the driver's side window rolls down just enough for his hand to pop out and wave me in. It was so out of context, but I found myself running across Falls Road and getting into the passenger seat. I don't know why he stopped. To this day, I think it was purely a moment of senior charity to a freshman. He gives me a nod like, I got you. Chris puts the car in first gear and peels out as we drive to school. He didn't say anything. He just effortlessly changed gears. It was so transfixing and super attractive. He felt like a mythological guardian. After about a minute, Chris's hand moves up to the stereo unit, puts the power on, and turns it up to start pumping Shaquille O'Neal's latest album. I didn't know I needed to like Shaquille O'Neal as a rapper until I heard it coming out of Chris's car. The bass was so strong that I felt my organs moving. When we got to the parking lot at school, I took so much time getting out of the car. I just wanted to milk this moment for as long as I could and have as many people as possible see me leaving Chris Papadopoulos' hoopty. Maybe it was longer than needed because Chris gave me a look like, yo, dude, we gotta get to school. I never really talked to him afterwards besides a nod or two in the hallway. In fact, I never had a conversation with him at all. The whole ride had just been communication through movement. But I had a glimpse of future success and my brain made a checklist. Stick shift, quiet stance, and Shaquille O'Neal as soundtrack. This is Mark Pagan, and you're listening to Other Men Need Rides.
We're going to go ahead and activate the clutch all the way down.
All the way
and then we could go ahead and move it to the center.
And then just get a feel for it. You know, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and in this car,
and then make sure
this ride to school wasn't the first time I encountered a stick shift. Or a man driving one. There was my older brother David, cool cousins, and also so many of my friends over the years who had older brothers who would drop me off in their five-speed Saabs or BMWs, blasting Motley Crue to Tupac, to U2, to Ace of Base. Nobody talked. They drove. And they shifted. During this time in my life, I was also watching James Bond and Italian exploitation movies. They always had scenes of sporty cars running through small Mediterranean streets with Charles Bronson or George Lazenby not saying anything. But their driving was yelling, "Don't fuck with me, bro." By the time I hit puberty, I couldn't wait to either be a European spy or an older brother type who gave lifts. And I couldn't wait for someone to stare in awe at the way I escaped from Greek gangsters or peeled away from Tower Records. I couldn't have expressed this back then, but there was an affection to being around young men driving a stick shift and listening to tunes. It was all so mysterious. Like, what's going on in their head? It looked like there was no insecurity, no self-consciousness. Besides the independence of driving, it felt protective and safe. As if this silent driving presence is how men nurture.
One, always be courteous.
Two,
know how to drive.
Remember,
three,
the defensive driver willingly gives up the right-of-way for safety.
The man who was supposed to teach me how to drive was my dad. He wasn't around all that much, and when he was, I'd run errands with him in his boat of a Cadillac. He was a terrible driver, and the thing moved around like a canoe in a world of jet skis. Plus, he was old, and his soundtrack was always this classical music that he'd have to hum along with, but he could never remember the correct melody to. This was my destiny, and probably my car. Right before I started high school, my dad passed away unexpectedly. It was a rough transition, but there was a lot of family support, lots of help. And as I looked at the change ahead, I had a hard time imagining life in high school without the guidance of my father. I didn't expect how strongly I needed and wanted a mentor. I started as a freshman at Winston Churchill High School. No one knew me. I didn't have to be the quiet guy who couldn't drive and still secretly listened to the Bodyguard soundtrack. This could be a fresh start. And as weird as it sounds, I figured if my dad was gone, maybe this meant I could get a new model of father. I knew there was a chance my mom would date or get remarried, and I was quietly excited about this because I was like, oh, we could bring a cool dad into the house. My dad was great, but he was old and did things like drive an old man's car and fall asleep watching the McLaughlin Group. We needed someone who wore jeans and occasionally smoked cigarettes. Someone with a quiet resolve who'd be tough on me in the right ways, but also be like, hey, hop in, kid. Let me show you how to rob a racetrack. All right, that's going too far. But, you know, someone who would offer me guidance on how to be a cool, confident man. My mom starts dating, and I'm wondering who this hip guy will be that she'll eventually bring home to meet me.
That was an interesting time of my life.
That's Lauren, the man who became my stepfather. And all those plans that I had for a young, cool dad did not come to pass. Because the way I saw it at the time, my mom went and married the oldest man possible. At the time they started dating, I was 15, my mom was 45, and Lauren was 70. And today, he's 93 years old.
I had just retired, by the way. So I was all involved in moving to a new house. The real estate agent was your mother.
Yep. My mom's a real estate agent. Her name is Jean. She's buddies with a lot of her clients, so I wasn't surprised when she and Lauren became friends. But then he started showing up at our house a few times a week, and shortly after that, he was there at the end of the night, and he'd still be there in the morning walking around in his old man underwear. I wanted him gone. But Lauren wasn't going anywhere. And on top of that, he was impossible to dislike. He never cursed or raised his voice. And he was so pure in his devotion to my mother and sensitivity to our needs.
Jean was so special to me. And I know very well that is a very difficult time for the children. My children as well as Jean's.
My mom worked. Lauren was retired. I was turning 16. They thought it would be a great idea if Lauren taught me how to drive. The last thing I wanted to do was spend time with him one-on-one. But I wanted to learn how to drive stick shift. This was going to get me out of this life and turn me into a getaway driver or a stoic hunk or both. And the only car in the house with a 5-speed was Lauren's 1985 Mazda RX-7.
I'd forgotten that you drove that car. Yeah, that's right. That was the time when we were together. We'd been buying used cars and usually sedans and station wagons as the usual part of a suburban living. And Mazda had put together just a marvelously engineered little car. That was one of the, probably the second car that I had ever bought that was brand new.
Day after day, Lauren and I would sit in this two-seater while I stalled out trying to get onto exit ramps on I-270 in Maryland. There was no Shaquille O'Neal, no Motley Crue, just my mom's boyfriend's voice and more humming along with his classical radio. And Lauren seemed to be okay with all of it.
You didn't have any problems. You seemed to be very comfortable driving it. I can imagine that there are some parents and their children, they wouldn't get along as teachers and students, but we were fine.
He was right. We never argued. He never raised his voice or cursed, no matter how scary those drives were. I got pretty good at driving 5-speed transmissions. And if a day went especially well, Lauren would have me drive down 355 and ask me to pull into the parking lot of heaven, Popeye's Chicken on Frederick Road. I don't remember us talking about much, but what is there to say when you've got Cajun fries and spicy chicken? It was all right. Lauren was all right. I figured I'd get the stick shift under my belt, and these rides would be a fond memory after my mom and him break up. One day around my 16th birthday, my mother came home and said, Lauren asked me to marry him. And I said yes. I didn't realize how much I missed my dad until my mom proclaimed her commitment to another man. On top of that, we had to move into his house and start sharing our worlds more closely. Our home, our habits, our cars. When I got my license at 16, I'd drive around as much as possible. One night I was out with my friends and had the RX-7. We were parked at some gazebo getting high, and when I came back to the car, the key kept sticking in the lock and I couldn't open the door. If I was in a regular headspace, I probably would have given it a few more patient tries and gotten the door open in less than a minute. But that night, I looked at Lauren's car and I felt a deep tinge of animosity and sadness. I lifted my leg and kicked the door as hard as I could. I didn't think it would be as dramatic a dent as it became, and even my friends were like, "Damn, dude." I said, it'll pop out overnight, which I honestly thought would happen. At 7 a.m. the next morning, I wake up to see Lauren standing over me. He says, "Mark, come to the garage. I want to show you something." We went into the garage. He stood there in his flannel pajamas and moccasin slippers, pointed to the door, and said, "What the fuck is that?" Remember, Lauren never raised his voice or cursed. The worst thing that any of us had ever heard Lauren say was the word preposterous with a lot of emphasis. I was completely caught off guard by this F-bomb. My mom had witnessed the whole thing, and I looked over at her like, "Come on, help me out here." And she gave me a look like, "You're on your own, dude." I started apologizing for everything. Lauren shushed me and said, "Dude, go get the plunger from your bathroom." And I thought, okay, what sort of weird mid-century punishment am I getting? I get the plunger, give it to Lauren, and after about 30 seconds, he expunges 97% of the dent and gets the door pretty close to its original shape. When it was done, I didn't know what he was going to say, and I was bathed in disappointment. And after a long pause, he says, "You want to go to Popeyes?" Now, denting your parents' car as a teenager is a slightly badass act of rebellion. But eating fried chicken at 8:30 a.m. is fucking gangster. I hadn't thought about all of this until I ran into this car on 4th Avenue in Brooklyn. When I saw it, I thought, there's a stick shift. This will prove that I'm a cool guy. But Lauren, literally giving a fuck, saved my life in many ways and more explicitly gave me guidance. And this old sports car model made me feel taken care of. After all these years, I never sat down to talk to him about that or about how he and the car ended up in my life. See, Lauren didn't drive as a teenager. He grew up during the Great Depression. We took a drive and he told me the story.
See, when I turned 16, I was in college, so I had no place and I had no car. Then World War II came along and I was in the Navy, so I had no opportunity to drive. Then I was in graduate school and gotten married and I didn't have any money to buy a car. So it wasn't until I was 32.
In his 30s, he started to teach physics and he was married before my mom to his first wife, Polly. They moved to Newton, Massachusetts. Lauren and Polly were together for decades. They moved to Maryland, had kids. The children grew up, moved out. But Lauren and Polly's lives changed in the late 70s.
Polly had been sick with muscular dystrophy for years. In the last 10 years, she couldn't walk. So there was a long period of my being a caregiver. One Sunday morning, she just didn't wake up. I remember my first reaction was, well, it's happened. That was the only way I could express it. It's happened. I knew all along that death happens. Here's the point in life where it's happened to me.
And a new chapter started for him.
I remember whether it was the next day or the following day, I guess I filled up with gas or something, and I had lunch at Popeyes. By myself, of course. I was being conscious of, well, I can do this. So in a way, it freed me up of the caregiver role that is very consuming. I remember recognizing that freedom that I had for myself. I was simply continued with what I was doing, and I still had direction, and I was opening up to a new life, not knowing quite what was going to develop.
This is when he met my mom. This is how we became a family and how he had a two-seater sports car in his life.
So maybe that was my midlife crisis or something, but I didn't feel it that way. And there was no other feelings of regaining youth or anything. That didn't enter into it at all.
I didn't realize it at the time, but that car is where we got to know each other.
One of the things that was interesting about revisiting this car, which not just that I learned on it, but I learned how to drive stick shift on it. And it was partly, I wouldn't have put this together. That was, I think, sort of our relationship, a bit of our relationship introduction as well.
As children, we just don't think, we can't even conceive of our parents as being other than our parents. I remember I was very comfortable with getting to know you. That was a very special time of my life.
When would you tell yourself you can no longer drive?
It's when I can no longer function, or I see myself as not seeing something, not responding. I recognize that as something that may well happen fairly soon. I don't know.
Do you miss not driving a sports car?
I enjoyed the RX-7, but that period's over.
I did not buy the car. Instead, I got a shrink and worked on my career goals. It might not have been the answer, but it was a step. I did, however, ask Lauren to join me for one nostalgic getaway. We went to Popeyes.
Five of them, so that's number six.
Pardon?
Spicy.
Oh, and that date that I went on with Shripa? You may be wondering if anything happened with that. I thought the date had been a catastrophe, but I did get a text message the day after. And while Lauren and I ate our chicken and biscuits, I had him take a look at the response. I don't know if you can read with your glasses, but this one up here.
This top one.
Hi, Mark. That was fun. I could have talked all night. Want to hang out again?
That's pretty good.
I thought that it, that she wasn't excited. So
it's hard to read people.
That's Mark Pagan in an episode from his podcast Other Men Need Help, produced by Mark and his team, Tanvir Mansour, Rebecca Seidel, and Ben Goldberg. Find Other Men Need Help in Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Family Ghosts will continue in a moment.
Wild Card
Wednesday.
Wild Card Wednesday.
Wild Card Wednesday.
Wildcard Wednesday?
Wildcard Wednesday.
This is so weird.
Wildcard Wednesday.
This is so weird.
Wildcard Wednesday.
Wildcard Wednesday.
Wildcard Wednesday.
Wildcard Wednesday.
This is so weird.
Wildcard Wednesday. Wildcard Wednesday. Wild Card Wednesday.
Ghost Family, as you may recall, our season one premiere told the story of a woman named Kayla, and by extension, her brother Ben, who died in a house fire in 2010. As you heard in the episode, Ben was a complicated guy, by some accounts a self-destructive recluse, by others a misunderstood musical prodigy. Ben's friend Christian is in that latter camp.
How would you describe his music?
I was prepared for this question, so if I... I haven't prepared this question for like 7 years. In my iTunes on my old computer, when it came to genre for all the music I have of him, I put the future.
Kayla and I spoke to Christian for 2 hours about his memories of Ben. Christian works in tech these days, but he credits Ben for awakening a creative impulse he didn't know he had. Towards the end of high school, Christian spent hours and hours talking to Ben about art, music, and life.
He was just very articulate. You know, it just seemed to come, like, words came very naturally to him. And I was saying how, like, during my early days of, like, wanting to explore slam poetry and theater, which became fully actualized in my college career, I always thought, like, you know, man, like, you should be going to Berkeley with me, too, to be able to, like, see all these different, like, you know, creative groups that I became a part of and to kind of, like, see that. And in particular, I was able at the time, after he passed away, to basically do a performance piece that was based on my friendship to him, which included actually a snippet from one of the songs that he wrote, which is titled "Everything Is Gonna Be All Right." And the song is only one simple refrain of that phrase over a very delicate piano melody. And it's a song that I've revisited, you know, for the good part of the past decade whenever I feel like lost.
This is a recording of Christian performing his poem at Berkeley in 2011, the year after Ben's death. Christian calls the poem "Death Scene."
I got this friend. His name is Benjamin. He likes to drink 2 liter sodas as if they're Dixie cups. He's watched The Dark Knight 232 times and memorized every single line. He's got this Kurt Cobain grunge with John Lennon specs and eyes blue like Bob Dylan and Beck's misfit sensibility. Yes. His name is Benjamin, and he's Benjamin since he could stand on 2 feet. I mean, this guy's got music flowing through his veins, but he ain't vain. And I ain't saying he's a prodigy, but probably pretty close. And in the same young veins where his music resides, he told me about the heroin drives, cocaine, the copain, Vicodin to keep you down, and down we went into the basement where I'd see your music. Watch you strum that guitar, play that piano, hit that drum kit so quick. But you see, Ben, my friend, has been dead since June 2010. And these news reports I see on the television, they don't paint the full picture of who you were to me. Because no, it's not about the fire or the smoke or even the roof that came crashing down, streaming hot like my tears did when I found out you were dead via Facebook post. All of us have blood on our hands. Our regret and neglect stain the tainted palms we dart into our pockets like a kid ducks behind his mom on the first day of school. My guilt, it follows me around like a personal size rain cloud. My thoughts don't drizzle, they lightning strike my memory because I keep hearing Ben telling me, "Christian, you weren't there for me. Christian, you didn't leave roses. Christian, I didn't see you at the funeral. Christian, my skin was burning! And you knew nothing." Then comes the rain to fall on the walls of my broken heart. And I don't know why I can't take that same road up to your house, park my car in the usual spot where we'd hit it off. Watch you wait for you to finish that cigarette as we drive around this lonely town for hours. The conversations we had about the girls, the love, the sex, the music. Because I was the interviewer, you were the rock star, but I take it back because you're not a star, you're a constellation to shine over me like you still do now, just in a different hue. And I know you won't come down as a martyr, and I won't harbor these feelings of contempt against the fake fucks that rolled your name around the dirt like a mud wrestler, and restless I feel always. But your music that I keep with me is how I realize you are set free from the negativity to fly into the sky and eclipse the sun that was my disbelief that you were forgiving into the very end. But I'm still ashamed. I'm still ashamed that I can't go back to your grave because of this restraining order called regret. And I have no choice on when I hear your voice. A lonely, calm response, like a game of Marco Polo played solo, and solo I feel without you in my life. And I still wonder tonight under this spotlight if it's my right to keep you alive. Is it all right? Is it okay? Can I get some answers, Ben?
Family Ghosts is hosted and produced by me, Sam Dingman, with Odelia Rubin, Jennifer Lai, Lindsay Cradwell, and Jacob Smith. Our story editor is Michaela Bly, our managing producer is Mia Lobel, and Andy Bowers is Panoply's chief content officer. Special thanks to Mark Pagan for sharing that episode of his podcast with us this week. Remember to subscribe to Other Men Need Help in Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Our Wildcard Wednesday theme is by Evan Viola and Dave Van Rock, featuring the vocal stylings of Shemiah Williams, Jacob Smith, Nicole Bunces, Laurie Tobiasen, Lindsay Cradwell, Shelby Jordan, and Emily Mulholland. For links to all of our episodes, bonus and otherwise, to find us on Twitter and Instagram, or to send us a note, visit our website, familyghosts.panoply.fm. We'll be back in 1 month for another peek behind the Family Ghosts curtain. And until then, thank you, as always, for tuning in.